If a foreigner wants to accept a job offer from a willing employer or rent an apartment from a willing landlord, what moral right does anyone have to stop them? These are contracts between consenting adults, not welfare programs. Welcome to Keith Knight, Don't Tread on Anyone. That is a quote from Open Borders, the Science and Ethics of Immigration by today's guest, Brian Kaplan. He is a professor of economics at George Mason University. We did discuss this book last time, so we're going to go into some of his other work today. See my last discussion with Professor Kaplan in the description below. Mr. Kaplan, thank you so much for your time.
It is a great pleasure to be back, Keith.
What is the paradox of democracy that you reference in your book, The Myth of the Rational Voter?
The paradox of democracy is that democracy is allegedly government by the people. If you want to win office, it seems like voters have to like you. And yet, democracies have many policies that, when you really look at them, seem bad for most voters. So why do you have a system run by the majority that has policies that seem, in fact, bad for the majority?
Now, what evidence or reasoning do you have to support the idea that voters are ignorant? On the face of it, it might seem, well, these voters, it's their government, and if they don't stay informed, they'll get a bad government, which is not in their interest. What evidence do you have that voters are actually ignorant?
Well, I actually go beyond that. I say they're not only ignorant, they're also rational. In terms of the evidence that they are ignorant, really, I can say the evidence is every single piece of public opinion research ever done that tests what voters know. You know, there's no one that has ever looked at actual numbers where you ask voters questions about the world where they have found that voters are even passably knowledgeable. So, again, I mean, essentially just think about how the typical high school student would do in a civics class, then realize most adults actually forgotten a lot of what they learned in civics, so they're worse than that. Right? It's like, wow, so the typical voter knows less about their government than the typical kid in high school? Yes, that is correct. And there's a great body of evidence backing this up. And you might hope that somehow adults would be paying attention and would acquire extra knowledge. It's the reverse is true. They lose whatever limited knowledge they had. So really, they are at a level of truly abysmal ignorance about government in general, about the particulars, what's going on, and especially they are abysmally ignorant about policy itself. They don't know what policies exist, and they know very little, of course, and really next to nothing or maybe less than nothing about what the actual measured effects of policy really are.
Now, all right, fine. You've convinced me that voters are ignorant. The solution, therefore, is to make sure that we spend tons and tons of resources, I don't care how much, to make sure that we have an informed populace so we can elect people who really represent us while doing it with a very intellectual foundation. Isn't that the best response to this shortcoming?
I'd like to say good luck. So show me any existing program that has ever accomplished very much along these lines. I mean, it's not that it's not theoretically possible, but it is outside the observed range, really. You know, just to go and take average Americans and give them an education so intensive and also so durable, they would actually have even a passably acceptable knowledge of what's going on. I do have one method that I think would be a big improvement over that, and that's simply having an annual test of political knowledge, and if you do well, you get money. Right? So, and again, the idea of this is not only do we encourage people to learn the material in whatever way works best for them, because usually when you just make people go to a class, they don't learn much because they don't want to be there, right? But on top of that, the idea of making annual is it helps deal with the problem of retention, because it is very well established in psychology that if people don't practice a review of their knowledge, they lose that knowledge. So to go and get and encourage people to reward people constantly for every year for refreshing their knowledge would be another feature of the system. You know, I'm not enthusiastic about this idea, although I do think it gives you way bigger bang for your buck than any kind of civics education that's ever been offered.
My point was that people in the marketplace are constantly voting with their money instead of having to wait for a vote on products that they love to live with. Do you think this is a good way to sell the idea of voluntarism and libertarianism?
I am surprised that it's worked so well, although I'm always happy to defer to real-world success over mere speculation. So if, in fact, it's true that people found it persuasive, more power to you. again, I think that most people would say things along the lines of, well, it's precisely because it's so complicated that I'd just rather have some experts in government make the decision and then I don't have to understand anything about it. So I'd rather just have some really smart people run the Federal Reserve and do what they're whatever they're going to do, and I don't need to know any more about it. So delegation is, I think, another reaction that people will have rather than let everybody go and buy whatever it is they want. And again, I guess I would also say that if someone was disinclined to agree with you, then they could easily come back and say, all right, well, I don't know the ingredients in my breakfast cereal, so how is your system going to solve that? I don't know. And again, you may say, well, you can decide for yourself how the cereal tastes, great. But what about long-run health consequences? That's something that you can't really do without sophisticated inference. Again, of course, to the point that probably nobody really knows. So much sophistication is required to figure out what really is the optimal diet for human health. There's no human experiments that would really resolve the question that we've done that would last for the necessary duration of decades. So tough. But yeah, I mean, of course, ultimately, I think you're making a reasonable point.
Now, why don't you think voters are more humble with the amount of ignorance they have? I don't know how, this TV is made, but I don't go around, claiming to have so much knowledge, but people don't do any research on politics and then claim to be so passionate about it. Why aren't voters more humble about their ignorance, more or less?
Right. Well, I'd say the humility is, or the lack of humility is rather, one of the symptoms of the much deeper intellectual problem that voters have, which is irrationality. Right. So there can be a person who's ignorant, but it doesn't do much harm because they say, well, I don't really know very much about this, so I'm not going to start pontificating or act like I should decide. That is a reasonable reaction to human ignorance. But irrationality is more along the lines of not only do I not know, but I am going to act as if I know everything, right? And as to why someone would do that, well, to me, just look at religion. All right, now, the typical adherent of religion barely knows anything about their own religion, much less the other competing religions. The number of people who do a fair-minded survey of all the alternative religions of the world and then pick the one that makes the most sense, if you can find such people, great, they're pretty much non-existent. And yet religions, of course, are generally extremely dogmatic, claim certainty about a long list of claims, most of which seem totally absurd to everyone that isn't born in that religion, right? So what's going on, I say, is that people get a lot of psychological satisfaction out of this pseudo-omniscience. I mean, people like the idea of, oh, I'm so great, and I've got it all figured out, I've got the answers, and these worldviews give meaning to their lives, and they let them bond with other people in that religion or religion substitute, right? So, there is this idea that's been going back for over a century that politics is the religion of the modern age. And I very much think that is a deep insight. The same kinds of people that would have gone into religion in 1700 go into politics now. The same kind of people that would have been at a fanatical revival meeting in 1700 now go to a political rally, right? And in both cases, the people that are there know next to nothing about even their own views, much less the alternative views. But there is a great psychological pleasure in the sense of being so well and having such a deep understanding of the world and getting to feel so morally superior to everybody else that human beings generally really go for it.
What is anti-market bias?
Anti-market bias is one of the four major errors that people make when they think about economics. So in my book, The Myth of Rational Voter, I first of all sketch out the main ways in which people who have studied economics with great effort disagree with people who have only a passing familiarity with the subject. And I've got four of them. But anyway, anti-market bias is this strong tendency of people who are not economists and not study the field to underestimate the social benefits of the market mechanism. And again, I say this even though I know very well that there are many, many economists who complain about markets, who worry about market failure, Paul Krugman being the most famous. And I say, yet there is a lot more common ground between someone like me and someone like Paul Krugman than between either of us and a randomly selected American, in that both Paul and I would basically be saying, well, is there a way for someone to make money solving these social problems? And if the answer is yes, then we say, okay, fine, then the problem will basically take care of itself. Whereas for non-economists, the very fact that someone is making money solving a problem is the very thing that sets their spider sense off. And my anti-market sense is tingling. Someone's trying to get rich solving a problem. That's going to lead to a bad social outcome. And that really is a big divide between the way economists see the social world and the way that other people do. Is, you know, for non-economists, people getting rich is a symptom of failure, and for an economist, the inability to get rich solving a problem is the reason to expect failure.
It's incredible that he can be so skeptical about market failure, but doesn't hold those same principles to the state. So people don't have tons of information in the market, so they make bad decisions. What are people omniscient about politics and politicians? Of course. Well, there's greed in the marketplace. There's greed in politics. Do you see anything that uniquely applies to the free market in a unique way, that negative and unique to the market, that doesn't apply to the state tenfold, considering you can't opt out of funding them and they don't have competitors?
Well, let's see. That's a tough question. It's a good one. Let me come back to that in just a minute. So, I mean, here's what was very revealing to me about Paul Krugman. Now, Tyler Cowen did an interview with him, and Tyler was able to actually ask him some really hard questions about why exactly would you think the government would do well. And here's the thing. Paul Krugman doesn't think the governments do well. When you actually get him on that topic, he's like, yeah, this government really screwed up. And Tyler actually had what to me is the million-dollar question of, like, you're very partisan, Paul. You really hate the Republicans. You really like the Democrats. And yet, if we look at a bunch of states where that have one-party Democratic rule, you're not happy with what they've done. So, dude, what gives? Right? And Paul did not dodge the question. He did have some thoughts that weren't satisfactory, but he did acknowledge the issue. And he even went and said, yeah, well, you know, in like your one-party Democratic states, then you wind up getting a lot of good old boys clubs, basically, and they're corrupt, and they don't really worry about pleasing voters anymore. And sometimes you'll get a pragmatic Republican governor in the Northeast, and that works out kind of maybe better. But no, let's not quite say that. But that was the gist of it. So, to me, it really comes down to, like, at a core level, can you just say, like, I just think that government is going to mess it up, or is it just a matter of it's messed it up a bunch of times, but there's no general lesson? Or in other words, I think for someone like Paul Krugman, he's happy to admit the government has screwed up a bunch of times, but doesn't want to draw the lesson of we should expect government to keep screwing up in similar ways in the future. So he wants to think of that as sort of accidental. So, for him, government failure is more accidental. It just happened. Whereas market failure is systematic. It's the way the system works. And if you were to say, yeah, well, it's the way the government works too, in a way, it would just be very hard for him to deal with that, and he does dodge that. But he's not blind. Like, he's a super smart guy, right? And again, when you frame it in the right way, then he does actually acknowledge things that you might be surprised he acknowledges. So, I mean, that was one of my favorite encounters. I mean, I wasn't there, but favorite expressions of his, well, the way that he thinks. In terms of problems that markets have that governments don't have 10 times over, let's see. I guess the best answer is the problem of getting of the transactions costs. So the key thing about markets is to make things happen, you've got to get people to agree, and sometimes that is so expensive that there's just no way to get it to accomplish it. And government basically has the ability to pull out a gun and saying, we're going to save a lot of money on a negotiation now because we're just going to do it my way. Shut up. All right, now. That causes a bunch of other problems, but it does save on negotiation costs.
All right. I'll give that one to you. But for the same reason, we wouldn't say, negotiation costs are high, therefore the Koch brothers have the right to initiate aggression against peaceful people to lower them. Well, we shouldn't give it to Doug Ducey or Donald Trump either.
Yeah. I mean, I agree, but still, that's the kind of thing I would point to.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you for bringing that up. Yes. What is anti-foreign bias?
Anti-foreign bias is another one of the patterns that we see in how non-economists see the world versus economists. So economists generally think about foreign trade or interaction with foreigners as being very similar to interaction between people within your own country. If we go and buy something from people, Virginians buy something from Texans, Virginians and Texans are both better off. And similarly, economists think if Americans buy something from the Chinese, the Americans and Chinese are both better off. Right. And non-economists don't tend to see it that way. They tend to think, well, this is interaction with people in another country. You see, they don't live here. They're not citizens here. So now do you understand the problem? And of course, there are some differences. But again, for non-economists, They're generally pretty vague about why it matters, and yet very vociferous in thinking that it's bad. So, you know, anti-foreign bias is probably best expressed by this little fable called the, well, let's see, it's just got a few different names, but basically it's the parable of the machine that turns corn into cars. The parable of the machine that turns corn into cars, and the parable goes like this. Scientist shows up and he says, I have developed a new technology, an amazing futuristic ability to transform corn into cars. And everyone laughs at him, and the other scientists say, you can't turn corn into cars. It violates all basic chemistry. And yet the guy goes and puts up a nice factory over by the docks, and lo and behold, corn goes in, cars come out. So people say, man, he's done it, right? And there's great amazement and rejoicing that you can go and turn corn into cars, until one day a journalist sneaks in the factory and he finds out all they have inside the factory are just some docks. And all that's happening is ships are coming in from Japan with cars and going out with corn. The end. Right? Well, not quite the end. And then the journalist writes up a story and exposes the scientist. And the government says, horrors of horror of horrors. They shut the factory down. They arrest the guy for violating all the trade laws. And everyone says, wow, what suckers we were. Of course you can't turn corn into cars. It's ridiculous. Right? And the moral of this parable is that he did have a technology for turning corn into cars. The fact that another country called Japan exists is irrelevant from the point of view of Americans, and is actually a plus from the point of view of humanitarians, because it means that at the same time that we are benefiting, so too are the people in the country that we are trading with.
What is make-work bias?
Yes, make-work bias is yet another of the big patterns we see in public opinion. It comes down to rating economic success based upon effort or employment rather than production. So for economists, the key thing for an economy is getting as much production out of as few resources as possible. On the other hand, for non-economists, it generally kind of revolves around finding jobs for people. And yet, if you really took this approach seriously, then like tractors are bad. We shouldn't have tractors. We shouldn't have Expedia because it put travel agents out of work and so on. Right. So again, especially during a time of high unemployment, it's a very tempting way to look at the world and just think about saving jobs. But it is an atavistic mentality that if it had been followed in the past would have left us left us living in poverty to this day.
Yeah, you mentioned the excellent example of agricultural work going from 95% of employment in America to like 2%. And it's not like we've sacrificed production. The other thing I was thinking of, you had an immigration debate where you said basically the problem with COVID is people can't migrate to where they want to go now within the U.S. And you said something, I'm sorry, I'm just doing this off my head. You said something to the extent of it's easier to not like something where we don't see the benefits, whereas it's harder to get people or it's easier to get people to see the costs when they've been experiencing them before. Do you remember the point you were making?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. All right. So right now with, for example, immigration, if my open borders book is correct, and I think it is, that's why I wrote it, it is possible to dramatically increase the production of the world by deregulating immigration, so that people can go and move from places where their labor produces little, like Haiti, to places where their labor produces a lot, like Florida, right? And in the process, the migrants won't just enrich themselves, they'll enrich all their customers because there'll be a lot more production, all right? But it's hard to get people excited about this because you're telling them about something that they never had that they could have. On the other hand, during the early months of COVID, we got to lose a bunch of things that we have been used to. We got to lose most of the businesses that we're used to patronizing. We got to lose most of our opportunities for socializing with other people. We got to lose most of our opportunities for travel. So at that point, almost everyone could see, gee, it's really bad to go and shut down trade in this way. It's really bad to shut down labor mobility in this way. It's miserable, right? And that's because we were losing stuff that we in the recent past had, and we remembered what it was that we lost. And yet, if people just grew up in a world where we had COVID restrictions all the time, and then you said, hey, just imagine a world where we wouldn't have these restrictions, how awesome would that be? Probably you would have just a lot of skepticism and just like, oh, even if you're right, who really cares that much? Why is it so important to be able to leave the house anyway? I've got a lot of video games here. I can walk around my apartment 20 times. That's basically just as good as going hiking in the mountains. And it's only when you actually get the opportunities and then lose them that you realize, oh, wow, it sucks not having what we used to have. The stuff that we used to have was great, and now we don't have it, and that's bad. And a lot of what I try to do in Open Borders is to make tangible the opportunities that people are missing, because they are fantastic opportunities. And I would say, if once we had them, we wouldn't want to go back. Just like I remember what it's like to have only three kinds of restaurants. You know, so I remember back when it was, you know, the Italian place, the American place, and fast food, and like McDonald's, right? That was my cuisine when I grew up. And at the time, we didn't sit around saying, oh, gee, we have such limited culinary options. And yet now, if you were to go and make and turn back the clock to the 80s, people would say, my God, what is there to eat?
Finally, on the myth of the rational voter, what is pessimistic bias?
Right. So pessimistic bias is a general tendency of non-economists to underrate the past, present, and future of the economy. So this means that compared to economists, non-economists tend to think that we are in decline, that things are bad now, and they're going to be even worse in the future. Of course, once in a while, things really are bad, like this year. Right? And I think overall, this is probably the worst economy I've ever experienced. Even the late 70s. Maybe not today. I think things have, you know, a lot of things have renormalized, at least in my area, although a lot of things still are quite bad. But on the other hand, we have the internet and some other great things that didn't exist at all in the 70s. But say in March, I would say that things, I would have rather lived in 1979.
Wow.
You know, without COVID. I remember a little bit of price controls and not being able to get gas, but you know, during the first month or two of COVID, I would go to the grocery store and it was like, Jesus, my God, a third of the stuff is gone and a lot of stuff I miss. And then never mind the social isolation and everything else. But anyway, normally things are improving a lot. That's why we have so much to miss, right? Now, pessimistic bias is interesting because on the surface, it's not really clear what policy implications it has. So obviously, for anti-market bias, it's going to make you have less markets. Anti-foreign bias is going to make you be less interested in international commerce. If you know, make-work bias is going to make you less interested in having saving progress and also more interested in trying to just have government save jobs. For pessimistic bias, logically, it's not clear what it even should, how you should react. Like, so, right, so stuff stinks. Now what? However, in practice, it does seem like people who are doomsayers generally are, in fact, anti-market and see as a reason for being anti-market. You might say, well, it's if you're in a pro-market or a country that where there's a lot of market policies, then saying things are bad is a reason to get rid of those policies. On the other hand, maybe in a country where you had big government, it would be a reason to do the opposite. I've talked to people in Sweden, and I say when whiners in Sweden, people say, oh, no, woe is us. Or in Sweden, so, oh, no, woe is us. Right? So I said, what are the politics of pessimists in Sweden? My Swedish friends say, yeah, like they're on the left there too. So like how far left does a country have to get before a pessimist is seen as being pro-capitalist? And you know, I think you really do have to go to the Soviet bloc in the 80s. In the 1980s, if you're a Soviet citizen saying, my God, the economy here is doing terribly, that's where people say, this guy might not be a big fan of socialism, actually. But I mean, basically, it seems to be a system where people think of capitalism as the system unless there's almost no capitalism left. So capitalism will almost always take the heat, even in the countries of the home of the third way. People still think of it as basically a capitalist country. And so their complaints are really lodged at capitalism. Right. And then sometimes when I'm thinking about this, I use what I call correlational bumper sticker analysis, where you just see bumper stickers talking about how terrible everything is tend to correlate with left wing bumper stickers. Not always, but I do remember this bumper sticker saying, annoy a liberal, work hard, succeed, and be happy. And there's something to it.
What is your thesis in the book, The Case Against Education?
Yes, my thesis is that a lot of the reason why education pays in the real world is not that you're learning useful skills in school, but rather you were getting certification. You're getting stamps on your forehead saying grade A worker. And the upshot of this is that while schooling is indeed, as most people think, economically useful for the student, it is not, contrary to popular opinion, very useful for society, right? Because while one individual can get rich by having really great stamps on his forehead, you cannot enrich an entire society by just putting lots of great stamps on people's forehead. For that, you need to get productivity up, and school is very bad for that. The very simplest version of what I say in the case against education is that people often mistakenly describe education as being a skill factory where you go there and they pour useful job skills into you. But the reality is that school is more like a passport to the real training. And the real training happens on the job.
What is your thesis in the book, Selfish Reasons to Have More Kids? By the way, you got to see Professor Kaplan on Ed Schultz's show discussing this book. I'm going to have that in the description as well. What is the thesis in Selfish Reasons to Have More Kids?
So in that book, I combine two different approaches to the world to get some practical parenting advice. So one approach to the world is something called behavioral genetics. This is it's really sort of an interdisciplinary kind of social science where you study kids that are adopted and you study twins in order to answer the question of why do people turn out the way that they do, right? So there's a general nature-nurture question that has gone on for thousands of years. Almost all of the work on this consists in mere say-so of just saying, look, obviously it's in the genes or obviously it's due to upbringing. But it's about 60 years ago that some researcher said, neither is obvious. The fact that you say something with great confidence doesn't show diddly squat. And what we really need to do is to figure out a way to break this pattern that people who share genes also grow up in the same house. And once you put it that way, say, hey, there are atypical families where this occurs. So when you look at study kids that are adopted, you can say, hey, they shared the upbringing of the family that raised them, obviously, but they don't share the genes, right? Or you can go and look at identical twins and say, hey, just like other siblings, they were raised together, but unlike other siblings, they have 100% of genetic similarity. So let's go and measure the extra similarity between identical twins compared to either fraternal twins or normal siblings. So anyway, this kind of research has gone on in medicine, in sociology, in psychology, economics, right? And the general punchline of this research is that nature has been greatly underrated by most people. The effect of heredity upon a wide range of outcomes is much stronger than most people think, especially in the long run. That long run's important. So one common result is that when a kid gets adopted, he has a fairly high resemblance to his adopting family when he's a child. But when you come back and look at adulthood, most of it wears off. All right, so that's behavioral genetics. And it says that heredity matters a lot more than most people think. Upbringing matters a lot less than people think. Then we go over to economics, where we have this area called economics of the family. And there's a usual view that people are, you'll begin with an obvious fact that in general, and especially in wealthier families, there's a lot of parental efforts, both time and money, put into trying to give kids extra advantages. And the usual assumption is this stuff really pays off. And therefore, by this reasoning, it makes sense that richer people, for example, don't want to have very many kids because they feel the need to put an enormous investment into each kid, again, in both money and time. All right, so basically, economists have been very quick to say, it makes perfect sense. And it's very prudent that both richer people and richer countries have small families because they want to invest in their kids and get the quality up. Now, what I do in Selfish Reason to Have More Kids is I put these two approaches together and I say, wait a second. So if the behavioral genetics is true, and I think that it is, this means that what a lot of parents today imagine to be investment is actually waste. They think that they need to send their kids to fancy private schools and get them great soccer tutors and piano lessons to give them a decent shot in life and to reproduce their success, and they're wrong. Actually, a large majority of the intergenerational transmission of success would have happened even if you put your kid up for adoption and he got raised by a totally different family. All right. Now, of course, the obvious implication of this, once you're convinced that some unpleasant things are wasteful, step one is stop doing them. Right. So yeah, if bleeding doesn't work, stop bleeding people. Duh. All right. But I then go and stick my neck out further and say, well, look, if it's true that people have been having small families because they mistakenly believe that you need to put an enormous parental investment into each kid, then once they realize that they don't need to make these investments, The next step is to rethink the number of kids that you want to have. So if it is simply untrue that you need to pour an enormous time and a money investment into each child, then you can get rid of a lot of the unfun parts of having kids, in which case maybe you'll decide that you want to have another one. So, you know, like when the book came out, there was a great little op-ed by a mom who said, you know, we've got two kids right now and we're thinking about a third one, but the problem is our two kids are currently in soccer and that takes up almost every spare minute of our time. And if we had a third kid, we realized we'd have to have a third set of soccer games, third set of soccer practices. We don't think we can handle it. So really she was saying that the soccer is like contraception. It convinces them not to have another kid. And I really just reversed that reasoning and saying, look, you're wrong about the soccer. Maybe it's fun for the kids. Maybe you want to do it, but it's not essential. It's not any kind of crucial part about growing up. And if that's what's stopping you from having another kid, just cut yourself a break and don't do it.
What is public choice theory?
Public choice theory. Public choice theory is one of many names for using economics to understand politics. There are slight variations in what the names mean, but some of the other names just include economics of politics, political economy, rational choice theory, formal political modeling, economics of governance, right? They all basically are names for the same thing. But public choice theory is the flavor of economics of politics that I have been historically part of. So it's very heavily based in the state of Virginia. For that reason, sometimes called Virginia political economy as well. But basically, it is a school of thought where the founding fathers were Gordon Tullock and James Buchanan. Buchanan won a Nobel Prize. And then they had an enormous number of students, most of whom ended up not being in Virginia. But still, Virginia is the capital of public choice theory on earth, especially my own building, really. Carroll Hall is sort of the capital of public choice theory on earth. And what distinguishes public choice, Virginia political economy or public choice theory from economics and politics generally? Probably the main thing is just that in public choice theory, there is a much stronger appreciation of the idea that we should predict the future performance of government based upon its past performance. So if government has done poorly in the past, we should expect to do in the future. And therefore, we should reconsider whether it is a good idea for government to do something at all. So this idea, again, it's not unique to us, but we take it much more seriously than people in other flavors of economics of politics do. So in other flavors, they'd be more inclined to say, could we rearrange a subtle rule of the committee in order to get things to work? And with public choice theory, much more along the lines of probably that if that was just so easy, it would have been done already. The real story is probably just that government, we should expect it to fail. And once we expect it to fail, that is a reason not to use government, even when textbook reasoning would say that government is likely to make things better, right? So, for example, a lot of textbook treatment of saying that government would be really good at reducing pollution with a pollution tax, and yet public choice theory might make you say, well, historically, when we put that kind of power into the hands of government, what do they really do with it? And maybe they just use it to go and tax perfectly harmless things, for example, in the face of pressure from the regulated industries.
And how would you define economics?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, honestly, what I would say is that in a perfect world, economics would be called sociology. In a perfect world, economics would be called sociology. It would just be the study of human societies. And that is what economics has become. It is the study of human societies. Normally, of course, we combine this with a certain semi-philosophical approach by saying, well, we're going to go and assume that people are generally rational and that they're maximizing and that people are self-interested. But at the same time, within the field of economics, there are plenty of people saying, well, we'll relax those assumptions. And once you relax all that, then you really just come down to nothing more or less than it's the study of human societies. There are plenty of dogmatic economists who will just say, look, if you aren't assuming rationality, that ain't economics. But then it's like, well, what about all those people who won Nobel Prizes for the economics of irrationality? It's like, oh yeah, those fellas. Well, I guess they are there, right? So yeah, I mean, anyway, to me, economics is really just a calm, cool, collected analysis of human society. Right. And if there was any really important feature of it that I say distinguishes it from, say, actual sociology, I would say that what is distinctive about you know, good economics anyway, not necessarily economics as practice, but what's distinctive about good economics is a very hard-headed focus on truth, even if the answers sound terrible. So in psychology, there's something called social desirability bias. It says that human beings, when the truth sounds bad, human beings lie. And they often lie so much and are so enmeshed in lies, they start believing absurd things. So a classic example would be something like, am I fat? And there's only one socially acceptable answer, right? No, you're great, very good, just the way you are. Right? And if enough people say that, you might start thinking, hey, wow, everybody's great. Everyone's at a totally healthy weight, right? So, and I'd say that where economics traditionally stands out is by having low social desirability bias, by willing to say things that just sound really bad if they're true, right? You know, then what would be an example? How about this? The main reason why some people earn a lot of money and some people earn little money is people earn a lot of money have high productivity and people earn little money have low productivity. All right, doesn't sound very nice. It isn't a nice thing to go up to someone who's working as a janitor and say, hey, you know the reason why you're not making a lot of money? Because you have low productivity, ha ha. Right? So obviously, that's a mean thing to do. Don't do that to people. But when you are talking about it in abstract terms, you've got to say that because that is obviously a very important part of what's going on.
Now, you mentioned in the notes of, I think this is in The Myth of the Rational Voter, a paper titled Big Bills Left on the Sidewalk, Why Some Nations Are Rich and Others Are Poor. That, I just love that title. Why do you think some nations are rich and others are poor?
Right. Well, I guess the honest answer is there's a whole lot of reasons. But in the new book that I'm writing, Poverty, Who to Blame, I say let's focus on the problems that can be closely tied to human agency. So there are some factors that are probably important where it's just hard to do very much about them, like there's a bunch of problems with being around the equator, for example, right? But there's nothing those countries could easily do about being at the equator. That's just where they are, right? So there are, you know, so like geography could be a problem, for example. Or again, right now we have an enormous amount of poverty caused by the pandemic. Some of that is by human reaction, probably a lot of it by human reaction, but some of it is just, this is a really terrible thing that's going on, right? But so in terms of bad policies that we can easily point to, so really big ones. First of all, you know, low economic freedom. So there's different measures of economic freedom, and I would say, and like an honest analysis of the data would say that at minimum, countries with really low economic freedom do terribly. Not only are they poor, but they have very low growth. So there, you know, there is a map published by one of the main places that does economic freedom, and they show different colors of the world based upon their levels. And basically the main result they have is that the countries in red, the bottom quarter of countries in terms of economic freedom, are economic disaster zones overall. So there's that. And again, it really comes down to just avoiding a short list of totally stupid policies goes a long way towards letting a country get out of poverty. And like, what are the truly boneheaded economic policies to avoid? You know, first of all, there is like old school Soviet style socialism, total terrible disaster. Second of all, full, you know, expropriation, where you just go and grab business, government grabs businesses and says, they are our businesses now. All right, that leads to terrible results, both because governments are terrible at running businesses and because it discourages business formation and investment. And then the last idiotic policy is autarky, just trying to cut your economy off from the rest of the world economy. The way for economies to do well is, especially if they're poor, is to integrate with the global economy so that you can learn and learn from and benefit from the most successful countries. So I'd say step one is just avoiding sheer idiocy. And in particular, it's super important to get multinational businesses in your country at a high level because those businesses are operating near the global frontier of productivity and efficiency and competence. And so not only do you want them to run as many businesses as possible, you also want them to be around as role models and as incubation centers for domestic talent. So those are the main things that I'd say in terms of bad policy. Again, these are just bystander measures. So I do think that much more radical free market policies are even better. But to make that argument, I think you really have to go and say that a lot of the ways that we measure official prosperity right now are just bad. Right. So, for example, right now we measure government services at cost. And I think that's terrible. Government services should not be valued at cost. They are worth less than cost, generally a lot less than cost. And so what this means is that countries with a high share of government output that appear to be just as prosperous as other ones with a low level of government, with a little smaller government, are in fact markedly poorer than them because they get less, a little bang for their buck because government output, so-called, is crummy output, right? But for that, we'd have to go into a much deeper question about what the economic statistics mean and how we should interpret them. Then the other big thing that I push per my book, Open Borders, is that however bad the policies, economic policies of different countries are, especially the poorest countries, the results would not be so bad for human beings if people could easily leave their backward and dysfunctional countries and go and work in rich countries and then send home money to family members. And yet, pretty much the entire international immigration law system is designed to stop this from happening. So that, too, is a terrible policy that causes immense poverty. Basically, it means that the safety valve that would normally exist on bad policy at the national level gets removed. And so if you wind up getting stuck in a dysfunctional country, you really now have to stay there and suffer under the god-awful policies of the country, of your country of birth, because it's just so damn hard to get to any country that works better.
Now, a large criticism of the free market system is that it puts profits over people, as Noam Chomsky likes to very often say. You wrote in an essay that private greed and public interest often point in the same direction. How do you communicate to the mindset of someone who says, I'm not about profit, that's money and exploitation. I care about people. That's why I oppose the free market.
Yeah, so what I say is, maybe you're right. Maybe you're right. Under certain circumstances, the way to get money is to screw over other people. But it doesn't have to be that way. Sometimes the way to get money is to make other people happy. And then to go and look and see what are the circumstances under which these two regimes occur. All right. So in, say, North Korea, So there are some countries where the way to get ahead is indeed to screw over other people, such as North Korea. All right. So if you're in North Korea right now, the whole model of the leaders of the country is to treat the people in their country like slaves, right? And rule over them by sheer terror, with slave labor camps, with mass executions, and to just treat them like they are cattle, right? All the way to the point of actually renting out your people to other countries to work there, and then taking almost all the money and using their families as hostages. So there are regimes like that where indeed profit leads you to screw over the other people. On the other hand, we all have a lot of experience with the opposite. For example, you go to a restaurant and you're saying, well, how is it this restaurant is going to make a lot of money? And the answer is obvious. They got to make the customers happy, right? They could sure be one disgruntled customer, no big deal. But if in general people do not like your restaurant, if they go away feeling bitter about it, that restaurant will go out of business. Right. And indeed, if there's a server that is rude and displeases customer, that server is going to make almost no tips and again will be doing very badly. Why? Because that's a situation where they make money by making customers happy. All right. Now, when you think about the free market, you know, as long as you've got competition, then the result of this effort to go and make money is to try to make customers happy. That is the plan. Right? It is a way to get people to buy in the first place if you offer people a deal that they like. And it's a way to get people to come back and buy again. And it's a way to get people to tell other people that they were happy. It's a way to get good reviews. So this really is the way that most parts of the free market system that people actually see face-to-face work. So again, you like just think about your people's experience with working with a business like Costco or Walmart. You go there, the stuff is super cheap. People go and treat you nicely. Right? You get stuff that you like for low prices. And if you're not happy, what do? You go to the store and you give them some unresellable junk and you say, yeah, I didn't like this TV. Give me my money back. And they say, is there anything wrong with it? Say, no, I didn't like it. And they say, here you go, sir. Thank you for shopping at Walmart. Thank you for shopping at Costco. That is the way that our firsthand experience generally works as customers. And when people look at that and come away and say the business is screwing people over, this is where I just have to say that is based upon a dogma. Your experience says exactly the opposite, and you are just talking without consulting your firsthand experience. Now, if you were to go and get people to say, well, what is really leading to dissatisfaction with the free market? I don't think people could seriously argue that their customer experience is bad. Which is really hard to be a consumer in the United States during normal times and say, wow, like I don't get good value for my money. I'm just getting ripped off. Things are terrible here. I think the main way that people feel dissatisfied with markets is as workers, not as consumers. For consumers, life is great. For workers, on the other hand, you do have this issue where you go and work at a job and the job is boring and people aren't very nice to you. And a lot of people have jobs like that. Right. And they also may very well take a look and say, hey, government employees, on the other hand, they have a really easy job and people are really nice to them. Their boss barely expects anything of them. Right. And for that, I would say a couple of things. So first of all, yes, government does go and treat their workers better because they don't have to make customers happy. So a lot of the pleasure of being a government employee is brought about as a result of the pain of the customers, so-called, who don't get good treatment, right? So again, a lot of the reason why being a worker in a for-profit firm is hard is because the firm really wants to make the customers happy. And often that means that you've got to go and work hard for an ungrateful and obnoxious person. All right, so that's part of the issue, is basically that government not having a profit motive doesn't worry very hard about trying to get high productivity out of the workers, and so they just get to slack off. Right, so that's part of it. Again, you know, another part of it is if you pay more attention, you say, well, there are a lot of jobs in the free market where people do get treated very well. Usually these are higher status jobs, higher paid jobs. And again, like I say, so what's going on there? So why is like low status jobs get less respectful, less pleasant treatment? Higher status jobs get more pleasant, more respectful treatment? And here again, there are two different economic principles that are at work. One of them is just that one thing that people will pay for in the form of lower wages is nice treatment. So if you are working at a fancy law firm, you're likely to have nice coffee, for example, the good stuff, right? Why? Because fancy lawyers are willing to take a substantial pay cut to get good coffee. On the other hand, if you're working at a 7-Eleven, probably the workers there don't want to pay a lot of money for fancy coffee, so their perks are going to be quite limited. So part of what's going on is just that higher paid workers take a larger pay cut to get nicer working conditions. Another part, though, is probably that people that have higher skilled jobs have more pride in their work. They have more of an ideology of doing a good job. And so for workers like that, you don't have to hassle them as much. They'll just do what they're supposed to do on their own. On the other hand, for lower skilled workers, again, this is a statistical generalization, but one that I stand by, there's lower intrinsic motivation. A lot of people doing low-skilled jobs are not that happy to be doing the jobs, have as much pride in their work. And as a result, to get them to do their job, you've got to monitor them more, you've got to hassle them more. So there's that as well. All right, so, I mean, ultimately, I would say that when you really step back and think about it, you realize, okay, so, you know, like, basically the people that are having the most negative experience with the for-profit sector are probably low-skilled workers. And again, that comes down to, first of all, they would rather have cash than better working conditions. But secondly, when you have lower intrinsic motivation, you know, like very few people say, I've always wanted to be a garbage man. So much fun. It's fascinating. I like helping people. Right? You are helping people, but garbage men don't think about it that way. It's something you do for the money generally. But when we're the kind of workers that do that job, since it's not fun, then your boss often does have to be the bad guy, because otherwise the workers will not do their job. Right. And in a way, you can kind of see this with government employees who are given an unpleasant job and say, hey, yeah, they're having a good time, but the customers aren't. The customers are really aggravated out of their minds by the low quality of the work.
I remember a woman totally screwed me over at the DMV when I was transferring a car. And I go back, I have to go back, I wait in line, and I go, I was totally screwed by the last employee. She told me A, B, and C, and this didn't get it. And she goes, well, who was it? And I go, well, she's not here. And then I go, oh my God, there she is. She just walked in. And the woman goes, oh, there's nothing we can do. You're going to have to start again. I'm just like, all of this lack of accountability I hear about in the free market, again, applies to the state. I was recently told,
what is this lack of accountability? There is a lack of people paying attention to stuff they don't really care about, like internet privacy, where people may claim that they're really upset about it, but Are you willing to go and change companies in order to go and have more privacy? Are you going to pay $5 a month to have more privacy? All right, so actions speak louder than words. This is much ado about nothing. That's my take on internet privacy. It's a ridiculous fear. I don't care whether people sell my data. More power to them. They've given me a great free product. They should be able to monetize it somehow.
Now, I was recently told that in the absence of a state, employers would more or less be paying one penny an hour to all their workers. And I said, well, why not one penny a day? And how come on the black market, where there's no regulation, there's not wages at one penny an hour? And then I found out that about less than 3% of workers make minimum wage. Yeah. So that, of course, is nonsense. Yeah. So what is it that makes wages rise?
Two things, productivity and competition. So if workers' productivity is low and flat, not improving, then even competition will keep wages low and flat, obviously. But if productivity goes up and employers competing with each other, then wages naturally tend to go up because the employer that refuses to give a raise loses employees or doesn't attract them in the first place. So, just imagine going and trying to run a Hollywood studio while paying minimum wage to major movie stars. You won't get any major movie stars. You won't even get mid-level stars. You'll get community theater activists showing up to go and be in your movie. And what kind of movie is that going to be?
I was always intrigued by the ideas of anarcho-capitalism by David Friedman and Murray Rothbard. And I eventually read Private Governance by Edward Stringham and then was just blown away and said, oh my God, this really is not just some philosophy in our heads. This actually currently is working and can work in the future. What was it that convinced you to accept the moral and realistic legitimacy of anarcho-capitalism?
I read those same books and then I argued with people and, started off saying that the anarcho-capitalists were wrong. And then the more I argued, the more I realized, well, now I'm more playing devil's advocate because their arguments are making sense to me. And then eventually, there's a point when you stop arguing, you switch sides and you realize, hey, now this is my own view. I'm no longer just trying it on for size. It actually is what makes sense to me. I guess in terms of the arguments that seem most powerful to me, it comes down to this. First of all, just looking at the extent to which the private sector already supplies the services that many benighted people claim must be a monopoly of government. And that they're just factually wrong. It is not true government must have a monopoly over police. We got all kinds of private security, more security guards than cops. It is not true that government must have a monopoly over courts. We got private arbitration. There's plenty of that, so not a monopoly. It's not true that government has a monopoly over legal systems, right? So when you are doing arbitration for credit cards, there's a whole set of rules. When you go to an arbitrator, there's a whole set of rules. These are not government rules. These are privately made rules, right? So once you realize then that it is not only possible, but it already happens that private sector does supply these goods, then the question is, why not more? Why not turn the dial up from where it is at 3 out of 10 up to 4 out of 10 or 5 out of 10, right? And I say that the more you think about it, you realize, well, there's definitely no reason you can't go to 5, you could go to 7, you could go to 8, you could go to 9. And then the question really comes down to what's stopping us from taking it all the way to 10, or as the Spinal Tap joke goes, go all the way to 11, all right? And that's where you get to the really interesting questions intellectually. But at the same time, it's one where also you can say, how far can we get? Could we just get to the level where the central government only just has a small army to go and take out any police company that starts trying to act like an oppressive government? All right. And it's like, should we be worried about that small army being the oppressive government? I don't know. But anyway, that's generally where I like to focus, is just always to start people off in reality and then say, we could do a little more. Come on. We got to be able to do a bit more. And then once we start moving up, where's the natural stopping point? And maybe there is one. But then again, maybe when you get to 9.99, it's like, is it really plausible that last vestigial part of government is what is keeping the entire system in place? Or maybe this is like one of those puzzles where you think that you need a support beam and you just take it away at the end and say, hey, the building stands up by itself. Check it out.
What is the most important thing you learned from the works of Don Boudreau?
Yes. So, Don Boudreau is the former chairman of my department and a great friend of mine. So, Don spent a lot of time on economic education. He spends a lot of time just trying to figure out ways of taking basic economic ideas and making them not only palatable, but just plausible and engaging for most people. In terms of his research, I'd say that my favorite research that he has done is he's done work on the history of antitrust, and in particular looking at the alleged horrible monopolies and trusts of the late 19th century United States. And what he did with co-authors is show that not only is there no sign that these businesses were especially awful, but in fact that the very businesses that people complain about so much were actually great pioneers in productivity increases, that they had large increases in productivity, and that they led to very large decreases in prices. So again, in terms of a normal monopoly model, in the normal monopoly model, monopoly is bad because it leads to low output and high prices. And yet these actual historical trusts led to quite the opposite. They led to high output and low prices. And so I think, you know, Don did a really good job of just putting the intellectual nails in the coffin of this horrible 19th century and the horrible monopolies, which again is relevant today when you see people, especially politicians, suddenly pointing fingers at the most amazing companies that ever exist in the world and saying, oh, they're terrible monopolies. Like Google's getting sued as a monopoly. Wow, it's a company that has given away a seemingly endless supply of fantastic free stuff to humanity. And now we're going to complain about them and call them names. And when you realize that people who do that to Google really should make you wonder, maybe people did the same ridiculous thing to Standard Oil. Maybe people did the same ridiculous thing to, the Aluminum Trust or what have you. So that's in terms of research. In terms of Don's overall body of work, again, just trying to figure out ways of making complex economics intelligible to a broader audience. He is the master of that. If you've read his letters to the editor, he really does a great job where someone might have very little background, yet they read his letters and at least they come away saying, I never thought about it that way. Things are at least more complicated than I realized. You might remember Bastiat at the end of, I believe, Economic Sophism says, my hope at the end of my book is not that you'll say, now I know, but rather just say, I don't know. I no longer am so convinced that it's a good idea to keep other countries' products out of our country. I just don't know. Right? And Bastiat, just to go and have some doubts about popular dogmas, he counts it as a big progress. And really often when I present a radical idea to a popular audience, I'll often say, I don't think I'm going to persuade any reasonable person in this room that I'm right. What I really want to persuade you of is that I'm not crazy. I start with an idea that sounds crazy to you, and at the end I hope you say, he's not crazy. These are interesting arguments. Maybe he's right. I'll think about it some more.
Final question for you. Thank you so much for your time, Mr. Kaplan. Who is your favorite economist, and what do you think were their greatest contributions to the field?
My very favorite economist. This is one is hard. I think I am going to go with Milton Friedman. So Milton Friedman, the most famous of all the Chicago School economists. He was someone who combined incredible technical accomplishments in economics and yet technical accomplishments of real world value, not just toys or for really smart people to play with a vast knowledge of the actual economy, as you can see from his great works in economic history, to doing great policy advocacy, high quality public policy analysis, combined with great salesmanship, combined with leadership. So Milton Friedman, he made new Nobelists. He didn't just build the Department of Chicago. He found talent that quite possibly would have floundered wherever it was, and he brought them to Chicago, and he gave them the confidence and the support that they needed to do new things. And again, maybe Gary Becker would have been Gary Becker without Milton, but then again, maybe not. So Milton gave Gary a lot of encouragement in his early years and got Gary doing some of his most innovative work, like the economics of discrimination. Right. So put that all together. Right. And of course, Milton Friedman is not without just cause, seen as one of the great free market advocates of the world. And on top of this, he actually had some success in the world of policy. Milton Friedman very likely actually was the pivotal figure in ending the draft in the United States. All right, it probably would have been ended eventually, but he could have easily accelerated this by 5 or 10 years. Right? So thank you, Milton, for this great work, not just for good policy, but for human freedom. So he did all these things, and of course did it with a great attitude, sense of humor, right? Great writing. So I am all the way for Milton. Love him.
Excellent. Professor Kaplan, thank you so much for your time. Again, the book is Open Borders, The Science and Ethics of Immigration. You will see a link in the description below. Thank you for watching. Keith and I, don't tread on anyone.
All right, Andy, thank you so much, Keith. And actually, all my books are available from Amazon.com, so check them out. And I would say the one thing about Open Borders is that it's my only book that is suitable for kids. So it is written for adults, and yet I know many children have read it cover to cover. They didn't understand everything, but a lot of kids like the book. So if you are looking to enrich the experience of your kid who's doing crummy Zoom school, or if you're homeschooling or anything else, I'd say this is a great time to give the kids some intellectual enrichment. So Tribe and Borders, again, it's the only book ever written where people's kids are taking it from them. So I'm really happy about that. Thanks a lot.
Yes, and I will happily second that recommendation. It's not just a list of facts. It actually teaches you ways of thinking. As I said last time, and I still stand by this, I learned more on page 165 than I have on any other single page of any book ever written. Thank you to everyone for watching. Have a good rest of your day.
Thank you. All right. What is